Very good afternoon. Is it afternoon yet? Not quite. Depends on where you are, I guess. But in Kelowna, it's not quite afternoon. Very good to be with you. My first trip to Kelowna was in the summer of 1969. We were on vacation. My first wife was from Oroville, Washington, just across the border. And we had our little daughter, Debbie, she was just months old. So we were visiting relatives that had never seen Debbie. Debbie, who of course was the first great-grandchild and the first great-great-grandchild on both sides of the family. So she was kind of special. Well, of course, we were checking out the Okanagan in Canada because in 69, of course, the Feast of Tabernacles was held in Penticton. Some of you may have been there. I recall it very well. 8 days in the tent, 8,000 of us, rained the whole time. And it was interesting, that particular occasion. I've been driving back and forth across the border since 1978. And, of course, I enjoy it very much. One thing I've noticed about British Columbia, when I first started coming across, you know, back in the late 70s, it was simply beautiful British Columbia. And it is beautiful. There's no doubt about it. It's one thing about living in the part of the world that we do. Everywhere we go from our home in Colville is beautiful, north, south, east, or west. But then I noticed it became supernatural British Columbia, right? And now I cross the border, and what does it say? The best place on earth is British Columbia. Well, you folks have a high opinion of yourselves and the place where you live. And I guess that's appropriate, because if you didn't enjoy it, then it would be, well, just not as enjoyable, that's all. So I hear lots of stories about Saskatchewan, though. I understand that's not exactly paradise. Tough place, Saskatchewan, huh? I was on a tour of the United States and Canada back as a junior high student. I don't think I was quite in high school yet. We went across the central portion of the United States through Kansas, and at that time the wheat harvest was on. We got east, went north, came back across Canada. And when we got to Saskatchewan, you could have believed you were in Kansas, except you were going the wrong direction, you know, from east to west, and pretty much the same landscape all the way across. I've never played hockey. I've never been to a hockey game. I'm sorry, I just afraid to admit that, but one of these days, I shouldn't have admitted that, should I? Now you won't hear another thing I have to say, though I redeem myself. No, hockey's an interesting game, but I'm from California. We didn't have ice in California, you understand, until hockey spread to California, of course. Well, it is indeed good to be here at the Feast of Tabernacles. I want to go back to page 15 of the brochure and give you a little update. Grandchild number 17 was indeed born Monday, arrived in good health, we're happy to report, little Anna. And so 17 grandchildren now, so that's a pretty good accomplishment, folks, when you stop and think about it. Linda and I have a son and three daughters, 17 grandchildren, and we've done all that in only 6.5 years of marriage. So I think that's probably a record, right? So bear that in mind. It is a bit awkward telling stories and going back into ancient history and recalling some of the past, because some of the things I talk about, of course, do not include Linda, and that's just the way it is. We understand that. And so that'll be a little awkward from time to time. But I'll tell you a little bit about the family and the grandchildren and the connections that we have there. It's quite an interesting story, actually. So number 17 was born Monday. So that was exciting. And that was, of course, the new mother is now 8 times over a new mother. And they're in Iowa. This is Robin, Linda's oldest daughter. And so there's the 8 of them. There's chaos enough in that family, you can imagine, 8 children. I can remember when we had two, and we were sitting there deciding whether we'd have a third one. I remember this quite well. And let's see, one, two, one child, two child, one mother, one father, two and two. One more and we'll be outnumbered. I didn't figure we needed another one, so we stopped at two. But nevertheless, in Oregon, there's the younger sister, Cherry. She has four children. Two of them were born in Iowa. They're Fiedlers. Two of them were born in Oregon. They're Hollingsworth. The first marriage ended in divorce. Now there are, like I say, there are two children, two sets of children, actually, a boy and a girl, born in Iowa, Fiedlers. Boy and a girl, Hollingsworth, now in Medford, Oregon. Now the father is in Bend, and of course, there's the custody issues and traveling back and forth between homes. And in Bend, of course, father has remarried, so there's a stepmother in Bend as well. And so you have those issues to deal with. There's grandparents, of course, in Wisconsin. That's the paternal grandparents. And then, of course, Linda is the maternal grandmother, and she's in Washington. And of course, I'm the step-grandfather in this case. And so we have that. So then in Spokane, I have my son, Eric. He has two girls. And of course, because my wife, first wife and I are divorced, those two girls have a grandmother in another Washington city. And they have their grandfather, that's me, in Colville. And of course, there's Grandma Linda, their step-grandmother, excuse me. And so we deal with those issues. Now, Debbie, my daughter, her first marriage ended after 10 years, and she had no children by that marriage. But she remarried Dave about 3 years ago, and he has two boys by a previous marriage, Noah and Elijah. I occasionally refer to them as the two witnesses. They look at me kind of puzzled as to why I would say that. But at any rate, there's Noah and Elijah. So, and then together, Dave and Debbie have Trent. So Trent's the third boy in the family, and Trent's the half-brother of Noah and Elijah. I'm the step-grandfather of Noah and Elijah and the full paternal grandfather of Trent. And then there's Linda, of course, and she's the step-grandmother, dearly beloved of all of them. And so we have that. All right. Now, of course, there are custody issues, too, because Noah and Elijah have a mother in the area, and so they're known to travel back and forth from time to time, obviously, between father and mother. So Debbie's mother, of course, is Trent's grandmother, and also Noah and Elijah's step-grandmother. Now, Noah and Elijah's mother is remarried, right? And they have now two children, in addition to Noah and Elijah, Marshall and Grace, who have been born. So Marshall and Grace are Noah and Elijah's half-brother and half-sister. And of course, Christine is their mother. And so Wayne, Christine's husband, is Noah and Elijah's stepfather, right? Did I get that right? Now it turns out that I shared an office at work with Jeanette. Jeanette's about my age. She just retired. She was our 4-H director in our extension office until just this past summer. Now it turns out, now see, Jeanette and I didn't know each other, never met until we were, well, maybe on one occasion, until we were both working for the Extension Service at Washington State University. And we just happened to be sharing an office. And so there we are. It just happens that Jeanette's son, Wayne, is married to my son-in-law's former wife, Christine. Are you following this? It's all right if you're not, it doesn't matter. Well, it sort of matters. And so that makes Jeanette and Alan grandparents, of course, to Marshall and Grace, but step-grandparents to Noah and Elijah. We had a little office retreat, and we do this. We usually rotate it around various homes of the folks that work in the office. There's usually half a dozen of us. So we're at Jeanette's house for this little retreat, and there Consequently, you look in the refrigerator and Jeanette and I have identical pictures of Noah and Elijah, and we share not only an office, but step-grandchildren. So, now the subject of the sermon is about peace. It's not funny, folks. It's about blessed are the peacemakers. Now, as you can imagine, there were some pretty tense moments from time to time as this history unfolded. You know what, with divorces and remarriages and custody struggles and difficulties of one sort or another, family drama often provides lots of opportunity to practice peace or to deal with the issues when peace does not exist. And so, I thought back to a time in the 1980s when my life was a little less chaotic. You know, we were all in the church. The Robinson family, there were six brothers and sisters, three of each, three boys, three girls. Five of them had been through Ambassador College. The whole group was in the church, and their kids and so on. And so here, my wife and I, of course, we had the two children, and everything was great. There weren't any divorces. There wasn't any of that kind of stuff. I remember reading a little, it was a column. The setting was around a Thanksgiving Day table, and the columnist was describing something similar to what I just described to you, relative to families and step this and step that and half this and half that, and all the connections. And of course, he was bringing in the cousins and the nephews and all the rest of it. Kind of puts you in mind of Grandpa Jones's song, "I'm My Own Grandpa." You've heard that one? It sounds funny, I know, but it really is so. I'm my own grandpa. And so sometimes things get a little scrambled, say the least. Well, I can remember in the 1980s, like I say, I was in Omaha, and we had a nice life. Things were going well for us. And I can remember reading that column and sort of pausing to think a little bit about this chaotic situation that this man, this columnist, was describing. And I thought to myself, boy, that's really too bad. You know, this horrible mixed up situation. Now, like I say, my life was not as chaotic as it is now. I thought to myself, if they only knew what I know about God's truth, they wouldn't have such chaotic circumstances. What a difference a couple of decades makes. And so I want now to pause and consider what David said in Psalm chapter 19, verse 12, "Who can understand his errors? Cleanse me from secret faults. Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins." Let them not have dominion over me. So the subject is peace, making it, pursuing it, and of course the family drama oftentimes gives opportunities to practice making peace. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 9, we're in the Beatitudes, and we're told straightforwardly, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called," I'll use the term "children of God" here, "they shall be called children of God." And so it brings to mind the relationship between God and his family, God and his children, of which we are a part. And when you think about peace, and you think about the relationship between peacemakers and God, the result of being a peacemaker is that you'll be called a son of God, a child of God, who'll be a part of the very household of God. It's a tremendous thing. We're hearing about that here through the course of the feast. And so I ask the question, how does God wish to relate to his children? Is he simply interested in obedience? You know, just do it. I was raised by a one-liner, "Yours is not to reason why, yours is but to do or die." My mother would throw that one at me when she didn't have time to be patient. She had all the patience with me she was going to have. My father died when I was 13, and there were four children. And so that made it, my mother had some interesting challenges with four children, you know, as a single mother. And so you ask yourself, so really, how does God want us to obey? Is he just interested in our reasons, or is he interested in our reasons for complying with his way of life? Does he want us to simply react because we're afraid of punishment? We know we understand as we go down the closing chapters of this, you know, this terrible world that we're living in, the deteriorating world, we know that there are going to be some very difficult circumstances. A person might make the conclusion or make the argument that, well, God just wants you to get in line. If you don't, he's going to slap you around good. Now, is that what God means when he says, you know, we will be his sons, his children? Is he interested in our reasons for complying? How do you think God wants his children to interact? How does he want you and me to interact? Let's turn to Psalm verse 34. Psalm 34, and we have a hymn. Perhaps Mr. Barrett has chosen this one to conclude the service with. Psalm 34, the psalmist says in verse 11, come, you children, listen to me. Here again is the reference to children. Come, you children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Now, it's unfortunate, I think, the use of fear. We have to always pause and explain what fear means. You know, he's not talking about terror. He's not talking about standing there shivering in fear before God, not knowing what to do or how to relate or do or anything. No, we're not talking that. But it's something that needs to be taught, nevertheless. It's probably taught best by example. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Who is the man who desires life and loves many days that he may see good? All right, so it's like we're asking for a show of hands here. Who among us, you see, desires life? Well, who among us doesn't desire life? Who among us loves many days that he may see good? Well, that's what we all desire, is it not? Well, he says in verse 13, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Depart from evil. Do good. Seek peace. Pursue it. It's like it's not something that's going to happen automatically, especially in the world in which we live. Depart from evil. Do what is good. Seek peace. And pursue it. So you want life rich and full? Well, it's related to speech. It's related to truth. It's related to what we seek, what we put first, how we set our priorities in life. And so it's important for us to recognize that. Peace is something we have to seek. It is something that is desirable, something we need to pursue. Let's turn to Romans chapter 14. Paul said some very important things about the subject of peace. And again, admonishing us. Now, he's been through the book of Romans. The Roman congregation had its troubles, difficulties between Jew and Gentile, between peoples of different cultures and so forth. And Paul's had to help them reconcile some of those things. So in chapter 14, he says in verse 4, who are you to judge another's servant? Now, this whole business of judging is extremely important when it comes to peace and the language we use with one another. It's about words. It's about speech. It's about how we relate, how we talk with one another, how we engage one another. Who are you to judge another's servant? To his own master he stands or falls. Indeed, he will be made to stand, for God is able to make him stand. So let's put aside these things that cause us to be divided. And here in this case, in verse 1 of chapter 14, he's talking about receive one who is weak in the faith, but not to disputes over doubtful things. Oh, we've decided, somebody evidently had judged that, you know, I'm the strong one, of course, and I'm going to invite this weak brother over, and we're going to strengthen him. And I will give him my wise insight into how he can cease being a weak brother and be a strong brother. Now, be careful of those sorts of things. We're all servants. So for me to point to you or to you, any of you, and say, you know, and complain and judge you for your shortcomings and so forth, how can I do that? We have to answer, all of us, to God. I can't be judging you. We can't be judging one another. Paul says, you just don't judge another man's servant. So let's drop down to verse 12. He says, so then each of us shall give account of himself to God. I don't have to go before God and give an account about you. You aren't going to be called before God to give an account about me. We're all going to give an account to God for our own lives and our own contribution, our own pursuit of peace, if you will, in this context. Therefore, verse 13, let us not judge one another anymore, but rather resolve this, not to put a stumbling block or a cause to fall in our brother's way. It's almost like he's appealing to us, at least do the minimum, folks. At least don't put a stumbling block in one another's way. I mean, life is sometimes difficult. We're forever trying to make our way around the stumbling blocks. We don't need fellow church members throwing stumbling blocks in one another's way, do we? And so we're encouraged to at least do the minimum. All right, now this business of language, once again in the psalm, he talked about speech. I want to review it just to make sure we recognize. Again, he said, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. All right, so there's a language of judging that we need to be aware of, and oftentimes we are not. Our culture has predisposed us to treat one another violently, quite frankly. The language of judgment, the language of criticism, and so forth. Every time, we go to school, what do we learn? We learn who's in charge. We learn who makes the rules and what the rules are. We learn who's deserving of reward and essentially who's deserving of punishment. And then we have to try to navigate the world based on those principles, and we get ourselves, and it's a difficult one to navigate. I will read just briefly from Marshall Rosenberg's book, Nonviolent Communication, A Language of Life. And he talks about communication that blocks compassion. Things that get in the way of our communicating, that alienate us, that cause us to be not at peace, but to be alienated, to be irritated, to be set apart in a wrong way. So he says one kind of life alienating communication is the use of moralistic judgments that imply wrongness or badness on the part of people who don't act in harmony with our values. We have a set of values. We're all trying to pursue the same set of values, are we not? Well, sometimes it turns out that we don't always see the value system exactly the same, do we? Such judgments are reflected in language. The problem with you is that you're too selfish, or she's lazy, or they're prejudiced. It's inappropriate. Blame, insults, put downs, labels, criticism, comparisons, diagnoses are all forms of judgment. Now, if you treat me that way, if we have a differences of opinion over something, whether it's values, fashion, whatever, doesn't matter. If we treat one another with blame, insults, put downs, labels, etc., what you do is that puts me on the defensive. There's no peace in that kind of a relationship. And what happens is the well of resentment that I may have deepens and deepens, because we aren't at peace. We're engaged in the language of judging. So you watch television. If you do, I don't happen to have television. There's no way I can control it, so I just don't have it. Don't have it at all. Don't have cable. Don't have a dish. Don't have a flat-screen TV. I'm really, really underprivileged in that way. But by choice. Right? But in sitcoms, what do you see? Just people bad-mouthing and putting people down all the time. And it's supposed to be funny. And even in dramas where there's a hero, the hero almost invariably will have to resort to violence, beat up the bad guy, or blow him away, or have him go up in a fiery crash of some kind. And what's the message? The message is, well, the way to solve our issues, might makes right. Now, when we speak this language, we judge others and their behavior while preoccupying ourselves with who's good, bad, normal, abnormal, responsible, irresponsible, smart, ignorant. Don't you do that? I do it a lot. You encounter somebody, oh, that guy's kind of abnormal. Well, that person's a little mentally off, you know, missing a brick, one card short of a full deck or whatever. Now, it's difficult in our culture to put all that stuff aside. Now, when you speak this language, we think and communicate in terms of what's wrong with others for behaving in certain ways, or occasionally what's wrong with ourselves for not understanding or responding as we would like. Our attention is focused on classifying, analyzing, and determining levels of wrongness rather than on what we and others need and are not getting. So when we are in the process of judging one another, we have a conflict with one another, we're not at peace, doesn't matter what context it is. There are plenty of reasons, you know, why people have conflicts. But whatever the context, we involved in a conflict and our values are not being honored, our needs are not being provided, there is a conflict, and so we oftentimes respond as we are preconditioned to do by blaming somebody, pointing the finger, passing the buck. Most unfortunate, does not lead to peace. Our attention is focused on classifying, analyzing, and determining levels of wrongness rather than on what we and others need and are not getting. Thus, if my partner wants more affection than I'm giving her, she is needy and dependent. But if I want more affection than she is giving me, then she is aloof and insensitive. If my colleague is more concerned about details than I am, he's picky, compulsive even. On the other hand, if I'm more concerned about details than he is, then he's sloppy and disorganized. It is my belief that all such analyses, says Marshall Rosenberg, all such analyses of other human beings are tragic expressions of our own values and needs. They are tragic because when we express our values and needs in this form, we increase defensiveness and resistance among the very people whose behaviors are of concern to us. Or if people do agree to act in harmony with our values, they will likely do so out of fear, guilt, shame, or because they concur with our analysis about their own wrongness. Is that the way you want people to respond? Is that the kind of relationships we want to have? Is that the kind of relationship God desires with each of us? Oh, we get our way. We talk people into doing what we want them to do, but for what reason? Let's turn to Psalm 23. Let's talk about the language of need. Oftentimes when somebody is engaged in inappropriate behavior, they're doing what they've been preconditioned by our culture to do when they have a need. And when we are in need, we don't know how, we haven't been trained. We have not seen a proper example of how to simply ask for what we need. We haven't been trained in how to evaluate our needs and to simply address the subject and request that our needs be fulfilled if possible. And so when we are in need, it affects our behavior. Psalm 23, you all know it. I can say the first words. What? The Lord is my shepherd. What comes next? I shall not want. Now, what does want mean? Because there is a shepherd, the psalmist says, I shall not want. We need to understand that all human beings have universal needs. We all do. We all share them. You've seen it exemplified and explained in various ways. I have here the pyramid or hierarchy of needs as put forth by that famous man of old, Maslow. And so we all have various needs. And let's go on a little bit in Psalm 23 here, and we'll discuss this a little bit more about how our needs impact our behavior and how we interpret behavior and respond to one another involves how we relate to one another. So he makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. Now, if you're a sheep, I've had sheep before I sold the farm a couple years ago. We had a little flock of sheep that I'd been managing and breeding for, 10 or 12 years, I guess. Of course, David was a shepherd before he was a king. And so David understood. Now, sheep's needs are quite simple. If they've got a green pasture to lie down in, if they've got, now it says still water, but it means waters of rest, they have an area where they can rest. See, sheep are commonly preyed upon. And when a sheep is capable of lying down in a green pasture and resting, it is because the sheep is convinced and trusts that there are no predators in the area. There are none. They're at peace. They can lie down. They have plenty to eat. Their needs are cared for. Verse 3, it says, now, of course, he's interrelating the experience of being a shepherd with the experience of being, a child of God, if you will. He restores my soul or my life. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. So we have a need to be led in the right place, to the right place. When we are born, we are utterly dependent, utterly ignorant. I explain to people in my job, especially we have involved in educational issues and whatnot, I always try to encourage people that ignorance is not a terminal disease. But you have to take the cure, right? And so we have to be led. All right, now let's take a moment here and discuss just a little bit how needs influence our behavior and how we need to look at the behavior perhaps with a different set of lenses. Maybe the behavior is not because a person is wrong or because the person is ignorant or some other aberration or mentally ill or whatever. Perhaps the person has a need that needs to be related to. And the peacemaker then must set his or her mind to understanding and empathizing with the individual. Let's take a simple example, a hungry child. All right? You got a three-year-old. The child is suddenly hungry. Blood sugar is down. What happens to the child? Inappropriate behavior. Will not leave mother alone. Whines and cries. Mother can't get anything done. But so you can't reason with the hungry child. And to say to the child, look, this is very inappropriate behavior. Shame on you. You're misbehaving. Now stop this. Mother is hurt and upset when you act like this. Now, what does that do? What's the message to the child? Well, I'm wrong. No, I'm hungry is what the child is saying, but the child doesn't know how yet to relate that. Well, that's an easy enough example. You've seen the situation also with a child who, one of our basic needs is, of course, the physiological needs, food, shelter, clothing, that sort of thing. And there's also, along with food going in, waste comes out. So you've seen this situation, no doubt. I got 17 grandkids. I know how it works. The child will put off, they're engaged in some exciting activity, and they just, and you can tell, they're starting to dance a jig, but they don't want to leave the exciting activity, and other things they start to do that are characteristic of a child that needs really to go to the toilet just now, but no, can't do it. And then suddenly the child realizes what? Uh-oh, I got to go. Well, sorry, it's time for Bible study now. We got to learn the Beatitudes. Now, so what kind of response you suppose you're going to get from a child who needs to go to the toilet, but you're making some demand on the child, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. Now you can have a choice here. You can acknowledge the child's need, or you can criticize the child, analyze the child, condemn, judge the child for poor behavior. Now, granted, the time comes when the child has to, what is it? Lead me in the paths of righteousness. Related to a three-year-old child, it might mean, all right, now we need to understand, you know, when it's time, all right, fine, but let's try to, you know, work it out in a little more convenient way. Let's don't cause World War III over, you know, something as simple as a peanut butter sandwich or a trip to the bathroom. So, again, a child fears abandonment or needs comforting or whatever. You know, you jack the need up a couple of notches into things that are a little less obvious. And the child is misbehaving or whatnot and maybe telling you that it has a need that has not been fulfilled. I can remember a situation I had with my one daughter, the first great-great-grandchild. I can recall on one occasion she and her mother were in rather animated conversation. Now, I'm away in my study. We're in Nebraska now. We're teenagers, right? So I'm away in my study, fulfilling my need for solitude and privacy and opportunity to study and prepare my sermon and all, right? But I'm hearing this animated conversation going on there in the other room. And I'm thinking, oh, man, what's going on? But I'm trying to ignore it because I got other things on my mind. And then the statement is, well, go talk to your father. So, I says, get ready. So she comes barging in through the office door. You know, totally, what's the term? Totally unaware of my need for privacy and study. Don't you know I have a sermon to give tomorrow? It's usually a Friday afternoon or evening these kinds of things happen. A whole week of tension's been built up from school and all that sort of stuff. So now I have a choice to make. This is inappropriate behavior. Don't you know you're barging in, you're impolite, you're et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I can engage in the language of judging, point out to her how wrong she is, when in actual fact she has a need that needs to be given attention to, and her behavior is the result of an unfulfilled need. On this occasion, and I have to tell you, I don't remember what the issue was. So she's up, so come in, sit down. And I'm, yeah, oh, I see. Oh, mm-hmm. I see. And I'm giving it this sort of thing, right, you know. Suddenly she stops, gets up, and walks out. Oh, well, that was easy enough. Later her mother said to me, well, what did you tell her? I mean, she calmed down, got up, walked out, went about her business, and everything was fine. Nothing. I didn't tell her anything. She didn't need to be told anything. She didn't need to be analyzed. She didn't need to be evaluated. She didn't need to be judged. She didn't need to be given a lecture about what to do, how to do it. Don't you know you know how to do this? You're being so immature. No, she just needed to be listened to. Now, you see, when we have an unfulfilled need and it's not attended to, it will affect your behavior. Now, what I would encourage you to do here, what I'm trying to encourage you to do here is to really think twice about how you respond to somebody's, quote, inappropriate behavior. We've not been taught and trained how to read those things, how to empathically connect with someone and really listen and really talk about what needs to be done. And sometimes, if there isn't anything we can do, sometimes all a person needs is to just be listened to. Seek peace. Pursue it. We have to put aside the language of judging and begin to assume the language and the behavior of empathy and begin to truly treat one another as brothers and sisters in Christ. Let's turn to Philippians chapter 4. Now, there's a lot can be said about it. I have to tell you this, my friends. Rosenberg here in the book also points out, perhaps the highest level of intelligence is the ability to observe without evaluating. We must evaluate, it seems. That's what we've been trained to do. We come through this little town of, I'll give you an example. I don't do a very good job. Since I've become more aware of these principles that I'm sharing with you today, I'm trying to follow my own progress, and I don't have too many good examples to share with you. I could give you a whole string of bad examples of how I observed and then evaluated. Fortunately, I don't have enough time to go through that whole list. But we're coming to this little town of Beaverdale, whatever it is, coming up here from the south, and we come in, and it's just a little wide spot in the town, you know, just nothing. I mean, we've got lots of little towns like that where I come from. There are tire marks all over the two-lane highway going through town. There's evidence that vehicles have been fishtailing. There's, you know, tire marks, black streaks everywhere. And I looked at that and I said, well, look at this. A bunch of drunken teenagers been through here. So how do I know it was teenagers? Oh, I don't know, just things teenagers do. Maybe I did that as a teenager. Let's see. Not with my parents knowing about it. But it illustrates the point. Well, there it is. I mean, it's obviously more than just somebody jammed on the brakes to avoid hitting a deer. That's pretty obvious. That happens all the time, right? Two kinds of drivers in Stevens County, Washington. Those that have hit a deer and those that will hit a deer. Probably not that much different in British Columbia. So it's very difficult to do that. To examine somebody's, quote, bad behavior and then try to look beyond and beneath the behavior. What is this person needing? What can I do to help? It is an extreme challenge to me personally. I'd rather run and hide. Because you have to become vulnerable yourself in order to make it happen. Philippians chapter 4. And we'll close here. And if you'll take note and in your study, you'll notice that there's a lot said about these principles. How to pursue peace. We have to view one another a little differently. Rejoice in the Lord always, verse 4. Again, I say rejoice. Well, we've heard similar things about that already, haven't we? And it's interesting, in Romans chapter 12, it says rejoice in hope. There are occasions, brethren, when there's nothing obvious to rejoice in. Difficult circumstances have descended upon you. You've been there, perhaps. I certainly have. And, you know, you can present the painful past in somewhat of a comical and humorous way, but it's only after years. And, you know, the tears have dried and you've gone on to accepting new circumstances. Sometimes we simply have to rejoice in hope. But we are not quite there yet. We got a lot of things we can rejoice over. So he says, verse 5, let your gentleness be known to all people. Your gentleness. It also means forbearance, your graciousness. The Lord is at hand. Now I puzzle at the statement, why did he put the Lord is at hand in there? He's at the end of the epistle to the Philippians. Perhaps what he said was, look, maybe it just came to his realization. Anybody, any of us called of God now, for us, the Lord is at hand. And Paul is reflecting to us, listen, brethren, we've got to get these things into our heads. We've got to practice them. We have to learn these things. This is boot camp in a sense. We're in training here. We're going to be kings and priests, holy members of the family of God. Are we about the business? How are we doing? Seems to me there's a sermon down the line about, are you prepared? Rejoice in the Lord always. All right, the Lord is at hand. Be anxious for nothing. Yeah, that's easier said than done. Have you ever tried that for a week? 1 week. Be anxious for nothing. This would be a good week to do it. After today, I'm going to be a little less anxious. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, notice, let your requests be made known to God. You have a need, take it to God and ask him about it. You have a need between people, you know, between brethren. We need to request it. We need to learn to trust God. and accept one another as fellow sons and daughters of in the family of God, and be able to request. It's difficult to request. Our culture does not like needy people. When we are needy, when we need something, when we are perceived as weak and helpless and whatnot, it's terrible. Well, who among us is going to make the kingdom of God without a great deal of help? But notice what he says. If you have a request, make it. Do it with thanksgiving. Let it be known to God. We need to learn to cultivate this amongst ourselves as well. Between husbands and wives, between parents and children. And then he says in verse 7, and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. I have to share with you, admit that for me, the peace of God, which passes all understanding, has come to me only in brief little episodes. And I suppose it's the human condition, isn't it? Because our needs are forever having to be met. The physical needs, of course, and you don't just suddenly get all the love and the respect, etc., that you need all in one day, and then that's it for now. No, it goes on and on and on, and we grow. And so the peace of God, I'm looking forward to the day, shed of all my cultural presuppositions, all my bad habits, all the things that you get settled into, ways of thinking. I'm really looking forward to shedding all of that and to really, truly, deeply comprehend and experience the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding. Now, there's something worth thinking about and meditating on. What does that mean? We've probably all glimpsed it a little here and a little there. I'm looking forward to the time when we'll all share in it 100%. So, brethren, we serve the Prince of Peace. Of his government and peace, there will be no end. We have a lot to learn. We have good opportunities here at the feast and afterward to learn to practice peace, to pursue it. So let there be peace, and let it start with us.